Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
Well, hey there, everybody. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz today. Do you like what you're hearing, by the way? And I'll tease this at the end of the hour as well. You can catch me elsewhere. As I like to say, everybody has a podcast in America. I have three. So if you're missing one of yours, chances are I have it. I have the show that I do with my buddy Jerry Rogers, Andrew and Jerry Save the World. I do a show called The Lunch Hour for an outfit called The Federal Newswire. And then in my gig with CPAC, I do a podcast for them called Swamp Secrets, Exposing Regulatory Dark Matter. We got a new episode of Lunch Hour out today. I interview a guy named Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom. You need to Google Federal Newswire Lunch Hour. That'll find it. Also, if you follow me on Twitter, at @Andrew_Langer, you'll find it there. Great interview with Tim Lee for the Center for Individual Freedom. Later on this week, we will have a special bonus episode of Andrew and Jerry Save the World. Two of the interviews that I did for at CPAC, one with Doug Collins, former congressman from Georgia, as well as John Schweppe from the American Principles Project. He's actually joining us later on this week here on Tony Katz Today, so you're going to want to stay tuned to that. Lots going on in the world. Obviously, we have the Supreme Court decision this morning. I may get more back into that a little bit more. This hour, we're going to be joined by Aidan Bozzetti from the Bull Moose Project, John Berlau from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We've got Super Tuesday tomorrow. I'll take the soup, if you get that old joke. On the menu it says super salad. I'll have the super salad. Anyway, hey, yo. Then, of course, later on this week, Thursday night, is the State of the Union. I am sure Tony is going to be able to give you the recap of that. Maybe we'll do a bit of a preview. With that in mind, there's a ham-handed segue for you. Corinne Jean-Pierre was on TV over the weekend talking about the State of the Union. This is comedy here. This is comedy gold. Here is Corinne Jean-Pierre, the White House spokesman, on TV over the weekend talking about Biden's accomplishments.
What I can say is, look, you're going to hear the president on Thursday speak about the State of the Union, obviously, speak to Congress, but also millions of Americans who are going to be watching. This is a president that has done more in his 3 years as president than most presidents have done in their two terms.
You know something? I'll buy that. I'll buy he's done more than most presidents have done in his 3 years. A, because they know that there's a strong possibility that they're not going to get a second term. And B, because Biden's been largely asleep at the switch, so he's allowed for the administrative state to run amok. How do I know, by the way? And I'm not, listen, he's done more. Well, that's neither good nor bad. I'm not sure I want a president to do a whole heck of a lot of everything, except maybe in terms of rolling back the power of the executive branch. But Biden certainly hasn't done that. In fact, Corinne Jean-Pierre is correct here. How do we know in objective terms that Joe Biden has done more? Well, the cost of the regulatory state, how much it costs the American people, the American economy annually, has gone in the first 3 years from about $2.25 trillion annually to just over $3 trillion. He's added almost $750 billion in new regulatory costs. So yeah, that's a good objective measurement as to how much he's done, and it ain't good. So you know, and what as we just heard, Eric Swalwell seems to think that it's just the misperception on the part of the American people. The American people aren't stupid, Congressman. They know what they're seeing in front of them, right? This is when Biden and other Democrats were complaining, boy, I wish there were a way to hide gas prices so you didn't see gas prices every time you drove down the street, because that's just going to make you feel bad. No, you know what's going to make me feel bad? There's that, but it's also the fact that, you know, every time I go to the pump, it costs me more than $50 to fill up my car. That's a little bothersome. You know, we're gonna pop down a little bit in the cuts that I put up there. Here is Senator Chris Murphy. He was asked. He's a senator from Connecticut. Chris Murphy was asked about whether or not Biden's mental faculties were all there, and he doesn't answer the question. Let's play cut number 10 here there, Carl.
Listen, I think the president is an incredibly compelling figure, and I would hope that the White House will send him out all over the country to just be who he is, right? He comes across as Scranton Joe Biden when he is engaging with voters, and I hope he does more of that. I think he will.
Listen, I certainly hope he doesn't campaign from his basement again. Again, going to have to agree with Senator Chris Murphy here. Send him on out on the road. Where I disagree with him is whether or not the president is a compelling figure. Now, is the president a compulsive liar? Maybe. Right? I mean, it was Bill Sapphire, New York Times, who said, no, I didn't call Hillary Clinton a congenial lawyer. I called her a congenital liar. A compulsive liar? Sure. Compelling figure? Yeah, not so much so. Now, they were talking. He was, talking about putting Biden out on the campaign trail. Biden's spokesman Kevin Munoz was asked to contrast Trump and Biden. Let's play cut number 9 here.
And it's really important that we understand that this is going to be a choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And we have to lift up that Joe Biden is working on the real issues that the American people care about. He is working towards peace. And Donald Trump is openly xenophobic, openly anti-Muslim, and would do nothing to actually address the real issues that the American people care about.
You want to talk about a word salad? In fact, you know something, Carl, I need you to play this again for me because I want to hear it again and break it down. Play that one more time for me.
And it's really important that we understand that this is going to be a choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And we have to lift up that Joe Biden is working on the real issues that the American people care about. He is working towards peace. And Donald Trump is openly xenophobic, openly anti-Muslim, and would do nothing to actually address the real issues that the American people care about.
All right. First of all, does anybody really think that Joe Biden is working on the issues that Americans care about? I mean, except to make things worse, gas stoves, getting rid of the internal combustion engine in cars, driving up gas prices, making it harder, putting racial scorecards on media outlets. Does anybody think the American public cares about any of those things or wants the government to be involved in any of those things and a whole host of others at that? Then when you get down to, by the way, that's the campaign spokesman. He's saying this. He is offering up these lies. Then when you're talking about the issue of peace, Donald Trump was president of the United States. We did not have these flashpoints. Yeah, I mean, listen, we were worried about things that were happening in North Korea. We were worried about saber rattling by China, but they didn't actually do anything. We had an unprecedented time of peace in the Middle East. Both Israelis and the majority Muslim Arab countries around them were experiencing, frankly, years of prosperity, even as the U.S. was becoming more energy independent. There was a period of unprecedented peace between those nations and Israel. We did not have Putin expanding his march through Europe. He didn't do anything for the 4 years that Donald Trump was president vis-a-vis Ukraine. It's a situation in which and China, we let China know that it was not going to be acceptable if they made moves against Taiwan. Yet, Kevin Munoz says that we're not going to have. Israel. Well, I guess I went through that. Kevin Munoz is going to sell you on this idea that somehow the world will be more stable. There will be more peace around the world under Joe Biden than it was under Donald Trump, though the track record says otherwise. It really is through the looking glass here. As of when we return, we're going to be joined by Aidan Buzzetti. He is with the Bull Moose Project. They're working on some fun stuff there. We're going to talk to them about tax policy. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. Welcome back, everybody. I am Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz today on Tony Katz Today. Joining us right now is a gentleman named Aidan Buzzetti. He is one of the founders, and he's the president of the Bull Moose Project. We're going to find out what that is. But let's start here, Aidan. Before we even talk about tax relief and what you guys are up to, want to get your thoughts on Nikki Haley's victory in the D.C. primary. This is a double-edged sword for Nikki Haley, is it not? That the only place where she's won a primary right now is in D.C.
Yeah, I mean, to start off with that, it definitely gave the Trump team a very interesting narrative on her first primary win. I will say that I'm one of the proud 676 Republicans who voted for Donald Trump in the D.C. primary. It seems, unfortunately, that most Republicans here don't quite share that opinion. But, I mean, it really does exemplify the point to which Republicans in the swamp itself are more of a, you know, moderate to liberal type of conservative and aren't really in on the Make America Great Again agenda that's been so successful the last few years.
Well, and let's talk about that agenda. Let's talk about the Bull Moose Project, because this is not a Trump organization, but you guys are advocating for very important principles. Talk about what the Bull Moose Project is and the Bull Moose Project Foundation and the work that you guys are doing.
Yeah, simply put, the Bull Moose Project is an organization that is dedicated to advancing these America First priorities. Our mission statement is to achieve a dominant American future. And the way that we achieve this future to make the country great again is to promote things that Donald Trump made a core part of his platform when he originally ran in 2016 and beyond. And on our foundation side, since you brought that up, we are in the trenches every single day working with state and local officials to put these agendas in on the state and local level. We've been working with legislators across the country to be tougher on illegal immigration where states can be. We've been working to prioritize family development, help people, you know, recover from the massive economic downturn and the rampant inflation that's been affecting everybody. So by and large, we are building out the groundwork for a conservative movement, especially in the Republican Party, to make sure elected officials that come along after Trump have the right priorities and the skill set to actually achieve results. Because as we're going back to the D.C. primary, as you can see, there are still a fair amount of Republicans, especially, you know, in the lobbyist sphere, that don't align with that vision, and we can't allow that to stand.
Now, let's talk about some of that vision specifically. By the way, we're talking with Aidan Buzzetti, president of the Bull Moose Project. You guys are working on this Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act. I want to specifically talk about the R&D expensing portion of it. There's a real – it's fascinating to me because there seems to be a real misunderstanding on the part of some folks on the left, not everybody, because this bill is bipartisan coming out of the House – that don't understand the relationship between research and development and the encouragement of research development and how we innovate. So whether or not there are folks who want to attack the concept of expensing for research and development, or the folks who are advocating for the Biden administration to seize patents under the Bayh-Dole Act, the Marchand provisions of the Bayh-Dole Act, talk about the importance of R&D expensing and the importance of research and development overall.
Yeah, no, I mean, R&D is why the United States, for example, creates the most drugs in the world, right? We are at the forefront of medical innovation. That's not the only thing R&D covers. It covers healthcare, it covers manufacturing, it covers any industry that could be improved whatsoever, even if it's by a margin of 5%. That is something that R&D covers, right? So if you are a company and you are spending millions of dollars to create a new drug, to create new medicine that could save lives, why would we not want companies to be encouraged to continue that behavior? Because when these provisions expire, the whole point is that these companies can no longer write it off
right
over in a year period. They have to amortize it over 5 years, which means You know, if you have a company that's spending $1 billion on a new drug, they can no longer just write it off, right? They have to incorporate the five-year write-off into their plans, which means that our timeline for research is expanded. And especially now that we're getting to a more competitive world in regards to manufacturing and military hardware, these are key deadlines, right? And on any area, right, the United States has to maintain its innovative edge. The only way to maintain that edge is to encourage private companies to continue reinvesting their resources into developing new materials and not just, you know, milking out money from their consumers because they have such a narrow profit margin now that they can't write things off.
Indeed, we're talking with Aidan Bozzetti, the president of the Bull Moose Project. So glad you could join us. Let's talk about the bipartisan nature of this bill. It passed in late January. The prospects for it passing in the Senate, which I'm not sure that there are, but and signed by the president. But let's talk about what happened in the House and whether or not it's got a chance in the Senate, and then for the president's signature.
Yeah, of course, Andrew. So the bill passed. 357-70. So it had overwhelming bipartisan support in the House, especially because, you know, Speaker Johnson pulled his weight behind it. And, you know, a lot of Republicans were really supportive of the intention of the bill, which is to make sure that businesses can continue to innovate and that we can continue to provide for families at a time of rampant inflation. On the Senate side, it's a little bit dicier. Now, some Senate Republicans have concerns over specific provisions, but it really is up to Majority Leader Schumer to schedule that vote on the floor. And we're confident that if that vote can be scheduled, the bill will pass. And I do believe that President Biden will sign it, simply because if he doesn't, it would be disastrous.
Yeah. No, it certainly would be. Let's talk about some of the other stuff you guys are up to with the Bull Moose Project. Tell us a little more about it.
Well, I have to say that the main thing we've been working on is working with members of Congress to support this tax relief bill. Outside of that, I can't say that we haven't paid attention to the border crisis. We paid attention to a lot of the ways state legislatures can start making sure that some illegal immigrants are no longer welcome here. There are a lot of measures that states can take to make life less attractive for people crossing the border illegally. But this does tie into the tax bill, because there's a lot of conservative dissent over some of the provisions on the disbursement of the child tax credit. The way that the bill works is that anybody with the taxpayer identification number, the TIN, as long as their child has a social security number, they can collect that that check. Some of the conservatives in the House and even in the Senate are a little concerned about how that might mean illegal aliens could collect child tax credits. But this is actually tightening the provisions. Trump, as part of the Trump tax cuts, they achieved a significant tightening of the requirements to collect child tax credits. And so part of what we are working on, especially with, you know, the border and illegal immigration being such an issue, is if we can get this tax bill passed, not only are we helping American business and innovation, not only are we aiding families in a time of rampant inflation, we're also solidifying into law that we have a tighter child tax credit service, right, that does not give money to illegal immigrants. That misconception is incorrect, and what we want to do is tighten these requirements so people who are not supposed to be here do not collect money from the taxpayers.
Hear, hear. Well, listen, Aidan, we got to leave it there. Aidan Bozzetti, president, one of the founders of the Bull Moose Project, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, go and check them out, bullmooseproject.org, B-U-L-L-M-O-O-S-E. Just what it sounds like, bullmooseproject.org. We appreciate them coming on. Listen, we've got so much more to get to on the show today. Going to be joined in the next segment by my old buddy John Berlow. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're going to be talking about some banking issues, but also Now, I got a chance to talk to him about the legacy of George Washington, something that he has worked quite a bit on. And we got to unpack what the vice president had to say over the weekend. I am Andrew Langer. I am in for Tony Katz today. And, of course, this is Tony Katz Today. Not 2 a.m. It's, you know, depending on where you are, 2:35, 1:35. Anyway, a little golden earring coming at you on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Andrew Langer in for Tony Katz. Joining me right now is my old buddy John Berlau. He's a senior fellow and director of finance policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I am, of course, a CEI alumnus. John, before we get into the Recoup Act, I want to hear all about it. How did you go about celebrating George Washington's birthday? John, by the way, is also the author of George Washington Entrepreneur, available on Amazon.com. How did you celebrate George Washington's birthday, John?
I celebrated it by, and of course he has, you know, there's the holiday, which is still officially Washington's birthday, and then there's Thursday, and then there was, it came 3 days later, the 22nd was his birthday. I celebrated it by writing a blog about an achievement this year that celebrates, as I wrote about in my book, George Washington Entrepreneur, that is celebrating its 250th anniversary, that influenced the Declaration of Independence. It was the Fairfax Resolves that he co-drafted with his neighbor and also a founding father, George Mason, that talked about England's violations of our rights and declared natural rights, as well as, you know, called on England, you know, amazing for the time, to do a cessation of the slave trade.
Amazing. I'll have to, you know, something. I'm going to go find that blog post and tweet it out. I want to talk about this because this, I've been reading more about the Recoup Act. I read, you sent me, you were kind enough to send me this thread that Cliff Asness put out there. Talk about the Recoup Act. Is it Operation Choke Point 2.0? Is it something else entirely? Tell us about this.
If enacted, it unfortunately could be a part of, very much a part of Operation Choke 2.0, which you see the bank regulators already aiming at cryptocurrency, at oil and gas, at these business, pressuring banks not to do business with these business sectors they don't like, plus the recent revelation of, you know, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, asking banks to send them anything like in bank app messaging, as far as the word MAGA and Trump and the word, you know, and or just innocuous purchases at sporting goods stores that might have had something related to, say, January 6th, whether it could be so far above from that or indicating of extremist activity. So we're seeing that the weaponization of banking regulation under the Biden administration is already, you know, beginning again, and this could be just be one more tool for this administration and any administration that we don't want to give regulators this power.
You know, it is interesting because, and you know, you and I think both would agree on this. I know our colleague Jessica Malugin, who does tech policy at CEI, we don't want to regulate AI, artificial intelligence, out of existence, right? Because we don't know what it is yet. But there is certainly a real danger along the lines of that movie Minority Report, which was going after thought crime and pre-crime, that all of a sudden they could use AI to go through. If they have access to these transactions in our bank records, it really could become a problem in terms of picking out. Not, listen, we don't have to go to Minority Report. We could go to Captain America Civil War and the Insight program that they had there in terms of targeting people who could be labeled as enemies of the state. I mean, are you concerned about that, John?
Well, very much. I'm very much concerned, but I think the answer to those concerns is just follow, you know, the Fourth Amendment to get a warrant, and that's what's that's what they're trying to say. The government is saying, in a way, since the 70s and 80s, the tech is different, and the courts have developed, and although now they're finally starting to put some limits, the third-party doctrine that if you give your records to a bank and voluntarily surrender, then you no longer have rights to that, and that the bank doesn't have Fourth Amendment rights to resist it either on behalf of its customers. So the thing with suspicious activity reports, currency transactions report over $10,000, which has never been adjusted for inflation since it was put in place initially in the 70s, are just really, you know, sort of a way of, you know, like a backdoor toward, you know, where authorities don't have to get a warrant to get, you know, kind of, you know, private and personal information. And that's very, and that is very concerning to me, you know, with technology or even with old-fashioned papers, but it could, you know, proliferate with technology. The Constitution, we have to realize we don't end the Fourth Amendment when there is the new technology, and the contrary makes it all the more important.
You know, it's one of those things where I'm sitting here and I'm getting more and more concerned while I listen to you. By the way, we're talking with John Berlow, Senior Fellow and Director of Finance Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We just went through, I don't know how much you were tracking with this case out of Los Angeles, the safety deposit boxes that were all opened by the feds and ultimately the plaintiffs won. It seems to me that we're looking at an extension of that situation where the government argued that because I think they argued that because these safe deposit boxes were there, they had the power to go after this. I mean, is it similar to this in that regard? It's amazing to me, this idea that because you've chosen to put your money in a bank account and engage in transactions with that bank, that somehow you no longer have privacy in your transactions. Oh, and let me add to this, John, I'm sorry. As the government wants to move away from cash and they're talking about a digital currency as an alternative to cryptocurrency, that makes it all the, you have no choices in this matter. Yet if you have to use a digital currency to do this, then the government uses that as a justification. Talk a little bit about that.
That's right. For central bank digital currency, the government would have the ledger and be able just to look at it. Wouldn't even have to go to the, I mean, at least now there's at least some process. You know, well, banks are required to report some information, and then they go to a bank with a broad subpoena. But, you know, at least, and we've seen more recently some resistance being offered. I think maybe even that safe deposit case you mentioned, there was some, you know, lawsuit or resistance or something like that. With this, with a central bank digital currency, they would just have it right there at their disposal, this thing where everybody has used, you know, they would know the central bank, you know, or the government currency, you know, have the ledger and how everyone has spent it. So it wouldn't take too much for, like, agencies like, you know, name your favorite police agency to say, you know, oh, we don't need this messy warrant. You could just give it to us from the Fed. And I mean, I don't know how much resistance would be put up, and the Fed would certainly have it. So if anything, and then things like the Recoup Act, where they say you could fire any bank, just not if they're, even if they're failing, but if you don't think they've implemented an appropriate risk control, where they could say, well, we think oil, and this was in Cliff Hazlitt's quote tweet thread the other day, but yeah, also a letter that was signed by 35 leaders of conservative and free market groups, including CEI, Americans for Tax Reform, and Gun Owners of America, where this would enable a regulator to say, well, we think, you know, you're doing business with the gun manufacturers and dealers are a risk. So that means we can oust you as members of the board. That's what this bill, if it passes into a law, it's already passed the Senate Banking Committee, could do, the Recoup Act.
Not sure how I missed that letter, John. I'm hoping it is somewhere in my inbox and I just miss it, because again, these are the kinds of letters that I would have signed something like this, because I'm looking at all the folks who are on it. You're right, it's you, it's our good friend Grover, it's our old buddy Saul on News, it's Paul. I mean, I don't have to go through the whole list.
You still can. We can add you.
Oh, good. Add me to the list. Like. So I'll tell you right now. Yes, I will say it right now. Add me to this list. Because this is important stuff, man. So where is it? Where is the Recoup Act right now in the pipeline?
It passed the Senate Banking Committee over the summer. Then thankfully there wasn't a lot of action on it. But the big supporters, like, and a lot of Republicans, I think, on the committee, went along with it because it was right after Silicon Valley Bank, and they went out to sort of show their populist credentials. But now things have happened, like with this FinCEN, maybe the same deposit box came, and people are groups like ours are looking at it and seeing what the what it could enable. And I think at least on the center right side, and hopefully everyone concerned with the civil liberties, the tide will turn against it. But Senator Sherrod Brown, who's chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, is still pushing this, has said he'll bring it to the floor, or he actually has said he wants to tie it to a must-pass appropriations bill, like they're doing now to fund the government, where it wouldn't even have time to be debated, despite the fact that it doesn't even hasn't even been through the House. So this is a time for people who don't want this further weaponization in banking, like a lot of your listeners, to really let their members of Congress know that this Recoup Act is bad news.
So we're talking with John Berlow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. John, how do folks find out about the good work that you're doing as well as your colleagues at CEI?
Well, CEI.org is our website. We have this letter and information about the Recoup Act and other threats for our liberties and other positive thing and some positive things that could, get rid of some of the red tape. I'm at Jay Berlau on Twitter, JBERLAU. And the book that you kindly mentioned, George Washington Entrepreneur, is available at, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many other book venues. If you type in George Washington Entrepreneur.
I appreciate that. John, you take care, my friend.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
John Berlau, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Go and check them out, CEI.org. When we come back, some final thoughts. We're going to delve into the button-down mind of the Vice President of the United States. I'm Andrew Langer. This is Tony Katz Today. Oh, what a great song. Anyway, guys, hi, I'm Andrew Langer. By the way, I know. Listen, it's bad radio for me to comment on the music. I got a producer I work with who's like, I'll never talk about the music. I love talking about the music. Because in addition to the work that I do, the policy work that I do, the political work that I do, I adore music. This is why Almost Famous is one of my favorite movies of all time, because Lester Bangs puts it best. It inhabits you. It's in your car, it's in your headphones, it's on your stereo. And I like lots of different kinds of music, whether or not it is, R&B and soul, like a little Wilson Pickett or the Sam and Dave that we've played as well, or the 80s rock or whatever. My wife cringes because I love disco. Anyway, so it all sort of inhabits it all. So I am going to comment on that. I just, it sets the tone. It lifts me up in a time when we all need to be lifted up. In any case, I mean, show tunes. Yeah. All right. Without a doubt. I was talking to somebody yesterday on a Reddit friend of mine and just threw out a quote from a Sondheim musical. It went right over their head, but what are you going to do? Anyway, what John Berlau was talking about, I'll probably use this to sum up today. For those of you who are the uninitiated, you might not remember or know about this thing called Operation Choke Point. And this is the problem when you have a government that is cloaked in enormous power and that power grows. And at the same time, we give even more power to these executive branch agencies. The very least you can say with this Recoup Act is, at the very least, it is deriving from Congress. Congress is pushing this to give greater power to these banking regulators. But the idea is that anytime you give the government power to do something, it can be abused for somebody's political agenda. So Operation Choke Point was a thing back in 2014, 2013, that time frame, during the Obama administration, where they were using regulatory powers to go after entities that they had an ideological animus against. So they wanted to get rid of, for instance, payday lending, or as the rest of us call short-term high-risk lending. So they couldn't go after it directly, so they engaged in this thing called Operation Choke Point, which was to pressure using the regulatory power of the Treasury and the FTC and others to pressure banks and credit card payment processing companies to shut down the credit card accounts and the bank accounts of payday lenders or firearms and ammunition manufacturers and dealers. It all came to the forefront and into the popular mindset because they went after adult entertainers. And when porn stars all of a sudden found their bank accounts shut down under Operation Choke Point, well, then the major media noticed, because, of course, that's the thing. I had folks I was talking to out and out deny, call me a conspiracy theorist. And then the porn story came out and they're like, oh, my God, you know, they're going after our porn stars. So when you give these financial services agencies the power to start peering further and more deeply into somebody's accounts and transactions, well, that can be weaponized. Again, as John Berlow said, someone's buying firearms, someone's buying ammunition. Why are they doing that? We've seen this out there with regards to bank transactions generally. Oh, you know, they want us to report more than $600 in a year of transactions. So, you know, if I give my daughter money in college to, you know, pay half of her rent, you know, in the apartment she rents with a roommate, you know, that gets reported somewhere. Even though it's just money that's coming out of my pocket and going to my daughter's for her to pay her rent, that's a transaction that gets reported, which is just crazy. And so this is the next step. Oh, and let's not forget, because we talked about free speech earlier, we talked about the chilling effect on free speech with Cece O'Leary from the Southeast Legal Foundation, that, you know, they can do this to go after organizations like CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. You know, they could shut off their banks and credit card payment processing ability, choke off their flow of cash. Or, as also happened to CEI, they could get subpoenaed under the powers of the FTC, combating against fraud for articulating political positions that the administration didn't agree with. It's a very dangerous time. Listen, as I said, if you like what you hear here on the Tony Katz Show, Tony Katz Today, and you want to follow me more, Facebook.com/Andrew Langer Show. That's how you can communicate with me there. You should be following me on Twitter @Andrew_Langer, LANGER. I host 3 podcasts. I know that's crazy. And I just added the third recently. But they're fun, and they're all very different from one another. My show, Andrew and Jerry Save the World, I do with Jerry Rogers, the editor of Real Clear Policy. That's a conversation show. We talk about the big issues of the day. Though this week I've got a couple of interviews that I'm posting with Doug Collins, from former congressman from Georgia, and John Schweppe from the American Principles Project. I got the Lunch Hour with Federal Newswire. This week I talked to Tim Lee. Oh, and you're going to want to check out the next episodes of my Swamp Secrets podcast, because I got an interview with Liz Truss, the former Prime Minister of Great Britain. You're going to want to check that out. I am Andrew Langer. This, of course, is Tony Katz Today. Have a great night, everybody. Have fun, and please stay safe.